Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could listen today. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls. Before we begin today's show, I feel it's important to confess a personal bias. The on-air hosts at WILL are under a mandate to be neutral and balanced in how we approach topics. But I cannot do that during this hour. My ethics compel me to confess that I have a strong personal interest in this topic. So as a matter of full disclosure, let me state for the record that I am pro-guitar. It's not that I'm against other musical instruments, mind you, but it's fair to say, like so many other Americans and indeed millions of people around the world, I am guitar-centric. It's important to get that out of the way because during the show today, and in fact all this week, we'll be talking a lot about the guitar, its history and role in American life, and examining the range of expression the guitar has come to represent. Indeed, we will actually play quite a lot of guitar music on Focus 580 this week, something we don't normally do as we talk about war, politics, and the like. We are not doing this because of my personal guitar bias, but because the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts here in Champaign-Urbana is presenting a remarkable event called the Wall-to-Wall Guitar Festival, featuring more than 30 of the greatest guitar artists in the world and a range of musical styles that's kind of hard to believe. That is happening this weekend, actually Thursday through Sunday this week at the Krannert Center. And if you want full details, you can easily get that on the web by looking up walltowallguitar.com. And we will be plugging it quite a lot as we talk with various people. We're taking the opportunity to, in fact, talk with as many people involved in the Wall-to-Wall Guitar Festival every day this week on the show. So, to kick things off, during this hour, Focus 580, we'll be speaking with Tim Brooks. You may know Tim Brooks as a commentator on NPR's Weekend Edition. He is the author of 6 books, including Rich Man, Poor Man, American Guitar in 20th Century Pop Culture, and his work has also appeared in National Geographic, Outside, American History, and Vintage Guitar Magazine. During this hour, Focus 580, we'll talk with Tim Brooks about another book just published entitled Guitar, An American Life, published by Grove Atlantic Press. As we talk with Tim Brooks, you are invited into the conversation. All you need to do is pick up the telephone, 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. And your questions, comments, stories, and enthusiasm about guitar are welcome as we talk with Tim Brooks, who joins us this morning by telephone. Tim, are you there?
I'm here.
Well, thanks
so
much.
Good morning, Jack.
Good morning. I wanted to say I love your book.
That's very kind of you. It's obviously just from one guitar nut to another.
Well, pretty much. I think there are a lot of guitar nuts around Champaign-Urbana, certainly, and actually, you know, probably everywhere. But let me start by asking you to talk about the genesis of this particular book. It really is sort of two narrative threads, one of which sort of came about when your guitar got smashed on an airline.
Yes, it's a grim story, and anybody who plays any kind of musical instrument, I think, is advised to sit down and take warm milk while I'm telling this story, because this was now 3 years ago. My family and I had gone out to actually stay on a ranch in Colorado, and because we were going to a ranch, I thought I would take my guitar along, and, you know, we'd sing songs around the campfire, which we did. And on the way back, a certain airline that will remain nameless managed to handle the guitar so badly that the head was almost completely snapped off. It was cracked so far through that just a layer of veneer was holding it on. And I didn't know this, of course, until we got home and I opened the guitar case. And so I was sort of sitting there making these pathetic little whimpering, moaning noises. And my wife came in, and she's a musician as well. She and I play flute and guitar duets. She's a flute player. And she saw what had happened, and she said, I'll buy you a new guitar for your 50th birthday. Now, this was sort of code for, if you can come up with the money for the guitar, I will hand you the guitar on your 50th birthday, because we both know we have no money. But that's how the book came about, because she said something else which was very sensible. She said, you know, I think you should do a proper search for a guitar that you really like, and I think you should write about it. And that really, as you say, devolved into two kind of threads. One was I found that actually living just down the road from us, up this dirt road in Vermont, was a guy who was a master guitar maker. And so I asked him to build me a guitar, and I watched over his shoulder while he made it over the next few months. And so part of the book follows the making of the guitar. And the other part of the book, I got really interested in the way in which the guitar had made America, and America had made the guitar. And so there is a kind of a subjective history told very much in stories rather than, you know, facts and figures and model numbers. And the two go back and forth between them, and both arrive at the present day. So by the time you get to the end of the book, the guitar is finally finished. And we've reached the present day with the guitar now as the instrument that outsells all other instruments combined in the United States.
Yeah. Well, the guitar certainly makes for a great set of stories, you know, I would say. And I think probably every musician has their own set of stories. But the guitar in particular has been a narrative thread, as you relate in the book, throughout American history.
Yes, I can't wait until we get to the part of the show where you ask listeners to call in and start telling their stories, because everybody has stories about a favorite instrument being damaged or stolen, a love story about a favorite instrument. I have a line in the book that says something like, first guitars are like first loves, unsuitable, ill-chosen, and unforgettable.
Well, you know, there's a lot of politics in guitar history as well, which I find, you know, just fascinating. And we'll get to some of that. But let me just, you know, sort of start, you know, back, stepping back 500 years or so to the arrival of the first guitar on the North American continent. And basically it was the Spanish who brought it, which is probably not surprising.
Well, the thing that I found just fascinating about this was that I started out working on this book the way I usually do, by, you know, doing lots and lots of reading. And I was just staggered by the number of people who had assumed that the guitar had arrived sometime toward the end of the 19th century and somehow it was connected with the birth of the blues. And I started finding references to the fact that the Spanish, wherever they traveled, they would take musical instruments, partly because everyone liked to travel in style. And so, you know, if you're a duke or a count or a prince or a king, then every time you stop for a cup of tea or a glass of sangria or something, then you get all the musicians to come out and start playing. But also because they realized that in the New World, the indigenous population, you know, the various Indian tribes were exquisitely sensitive to music. They loved music. And the Spanish discovered very quickly that if they brought musicians along and musical instruments, the act of, you know, kind of subjugating and pacifying the Indians went much, much more smoothly. And so that's, in a sense, another political element. But in fact, I found a reference to the fact that the oldest continuously occupied settlement in the United States is St. Augustine in Florida. And that was first settled in the 1560s. And in the 1570s, there's a soldier at the garrison who dies, and amongst his possessions is listed a guitar. So the guitar had really been in the country long before the Pilgrims landed, and 300 years longer than a lot of people seem to think.
We have a caller waiting. I'll get right to them, but just one other question about this particular period. The guitar at that time was a very different instrument than we know it today.
Yes, I've come to think of it as being a little bit like the mandolin in some respects, because it was a much smaller instrument. It had far fewer frets. At that time, it had four pairs of strings. Shortly it would develop five pairs of strings, and then finally it would settle on six strings, although frankly people have always made all different kinds of variants of guitars all the time. It would have been played solo by, you know, somebody traveling around almost as if they had like a little backpack of guitar with them, or it would have been played with a consort of other stringed instruments, and it would probably have been, you know, the top instrument, a little bit like a mandolin in a bluegrass band. And it probably didn't have much bass, but it had that characteristic guitar shape, you know, the sort of the figure eight shape. It had the sound hole, and it was played either with the fingers or it was strummed.
We have a caller waiting. Let's include them in our conversation. Let me just mention again that we're speaking during this hour of Focus 580 with Tim Brooks about his one of his latest books, Guitar, An American Life, published by Grove Press. And Tim Brooks will be in Champaign-Urbana, in fact, later this week to take part in the Wall-to-Wall Guitar Festival at the Cranert Center for the Performing Arts. And let me just also mention an event where he will be speaking about another of his books. That book is entitled Rich Man, Poor Man, America's Guitar in 20th Century Pop Culture. And that will be at the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music on Thursday of this week from 2 to 4 p.m. So, and that's open to the general public. You should feel free to attend. I'll mention that again later. Meanwhile, we have a caller to talk with, someone in Urbana, line number one. Good morning.
Yo, you guys are sounding like kind of old-timers glorifying the guitar here in American life, because today, people under 30, by far the most popular kind of music is hip-hop, with people rapping over electronic backgrounds. And guitar, rock band kind of stuff just seems to be something that's on the way out, remembered as part of the good old days. I'll hang up, and you guys can comment on that.
Okay.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Well, that's a really interesting question, and there was a period of time when I wondered whether, in fact, that was true, because one of the interesting developments has been the development almost of a kind of a non-instrument culture in rap and certain kinds of hip-hop, where people are making music without actually playing instruments. And that the caller is absolutely right. That's very popular stuff. On the other hand, there are all kinds of areas of music where the guitar is as popular as it ever was. So, for example, in country music, the guitar is absolutely obligatory. And country music is really one of the principal areas where the guitar sort of slowly rose to this position of national dominance. So I think that the whole classic rock era that he's talking about, that whole kind of late 60s through the 70s in particular, which you still hear on the classic rock stations, yeah, that's sort of sounding dated, although I have a suspicion that people will still be listening to Pink Floyd, you know, in 75 years' time.
Right.
But there's just so much more going on with the guitar than anyone tends to think, and one of the things that I try and do in the book is to look at how the guitar kind of infiltrated all different kinds of cultural niches and was a lot broader than it may seem. Jack, one quick point. The thing that you're referring to as another book of mine is actually just the title of the talk.
Oh, okay.
At the center there.
Well, maybe it'll become a book. I don't know.
Well, who knows, right?
Okay, well, good to know. I misunderstood that, obviously. Well, we have several people waiting, and let's go on and talk with some more listeners. Next up in Urbana, caller line number two. Good morning.
Hello. Yeah, I wish you'd, on your program or as part of the advertising campaign, play some of the music. I'm well aware of the guitar festival, but I'm not induced to go unless I hear some music. You know, I don't want to go and hear some flamenco guitarist. Not that that's isn't good music, but it just isn't my bag. So if you would play some, that would, I'm sure, induce a lot of people, motivate people to attend if they like the music. So
okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that suggestion. And in fact, we will be playing a lot of music this week. I thought that for today's show, we would simply talk about the book from our guest. Perhaps I should have been thinking more, sonically here. But just to give you an idea, there will be, in fact, some flamenco music, but there will also be jazz and blues, rock and roll, classical, country, African, you name it, Arabic music. In fact, tomorrow we're going to be speaking with Simone Shaheen, who is an Arabic oud player, a fantastic artist. On Thursday, we'll be speaking with Vernon Reed from rock hip-hop group. Well, it wasn't, I guess hip-hop in a sense, sort of it's hard to define, Living Color, and he's continued on in very interesting recordings and so forth. So I mean, there's such a wide range of music. We'll play some representative samples, but I'm sure there's a lot there that people will enjoy, and we'll try to give you a taste of that later in the week. So, hope that helps. We'll go on next to someone in Kingman on line number four. Good morning.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Good morning.
Yes.
I love the guitar. I think it's a remarkably versatile and creative instrument. I play a dulcimer myself, mm-hmm. and I bought a guitar for my son, but have had trouble finding somebody to give him guitar lessons. And so I'm wondering why schools put so much emphasis on trumpets and brass instruments and band instruments instead of guitars and pianos, which are just very much more practical on a day-to-day, human-to-human basis. And that's all I had to say. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you.
That is a fantastic question. And one of the things that I kept asking myself is, how do people learn the guitar? And I have a theory, in fact, that one of the reasons why the guitar is going to carry on being cool is because it's not made mandatory in schools. The answer to your question about, you know, why isn't there guitar in there in band and chorus or just guitar classes, there are a very small number of schools that actually do have somebody who will teach the guitar, who may well not be a music teacher, by the way. But by and large, there is this this very, very old-fashioned division which says that, you know, when you take up an instrument in even in elementary school, my daughter's elementary school was visited by a representative of the company that does all of the musical instrument rentals in the state of Vermont. And I happen to know that that company only has about 8 guitars. All of the other instruments, the classical orchestra instruments, you know, they have stacks of, they have warehouses full of them. And they go out sort of like the guy in The Music Man, and they go and rent these out and, you know, make a decent living doing so. I think the answer to your question as to why this isn't happening more is a combination of the issue of respectability, plus the fact that the whole issue of bringing a guitar into a classical classroom, you know, a classroom that's doing, say, band or orchestra, is tricky because classical guitar requires actually skill to play, unlike most guitar. There's training involved, and the number of classical guitar teachers who are available to teach in elementary or middle schools is virtually zero. So you have this strange situation where the teacher, the music teacher, may well be classically trained and may not play the classical guitar. You don't have many guitars for rent, but you have kids who are, you know, roaming the halls of the school who want to play the guitar. And consequently, you tend to get all kinds of informal things happening, like, you know, kids learning from each other or, you know, starting their own bands and playing very, very badly. And that's sort of the way it has always been. And there are exceptions to that. And in the book, in fact, I went to a school where they actually do have a guitar class. And it was wonderful because the teacher really didn't even play the guitar, but he had the common sense to just let the kids get on with it. And they had a great time. Mm-hmm. It was the only class in the entire school, I'm sure, where they were learning stuff even before the teacher arrived, and they refused to stop learning all class. In answer to your particular question about where can you find a guitar teacher, usually the best way of contact is through music stores. So I would go to your local music store, your local guitar store, and say, do you have somebody here who teaches? It's quite often people actually will come into a room in the music store and teach guitar there, and that would probably be your best bet.
Well, as you say, it often is sort of an informal process, and unless you're studying classical music, it isn't, you know, such a focused discipline, I guess. I'm not sure that's really fair to say that because it does involve a lot of skill, but so many guitar players that I've talked to started out, as you say, by music lessons at the local music store, and they may have done that for a period of weeks or months, but rarely beyond that, and they sort of take off from there and just learn from listening to music and playing, and just playing the instrument.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And often, you know, we guitarists have become proud of our ignorance, and we say, no, I've never had lessons, or no, you know, here I am at the age of 45, and I can play like this, and I still can't read music. And, you know, you sort of wonder how good we would be if we could.
Right.
But it's always been the way, and in fact, interestingly enough, this also has it's almost like an accident of history, which is that the guitar was, in fact, a very popular instrument in the United States in the middle of the 19th century. And then in the second half of the 19th century, two things happened. First of all, improvements in the piano mean that the piano can suddenly be built much bigger, can travel better, doesn't warp as much, doesn't break, and the piano suddenly becomes very popular. And of course, that's much louder than the guitar. And secondly, you get the development of the first professional orchestras. And those orchestras were funded by people who were extraordinarily conservative and wanted to do, they would, like Joseph Pulitzer, for example, gave large amounts of money to the foundation of an orchestra on the condition that they would only play the works of certain, you know, dead European masters. And so that pretty much cut the guitar out of respectability, out of the concert hall, out of the new definition of what classical music was. And so it went back to being a folk instrument, where it did pretty well.
We have a couple callers waiting, and certainly room for others if you'd like to join us. 333-9455. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Another Urbana listener on line number one next. Good morning.
Hi, Jack. I can't tell you how pleased I am to see this guitar festival come to the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. I've also had a chance to read Tim's book, and Tim, I really enjoyed it very much.
Oh, thanks, mate.
In fact, I contacted the guy who made your guitar because I wanted to see some pictures of it, so he sent them to me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's my principal criticism of the book, is that they couldn't afford color photography. So anybody who emails me and says, let's see that guitar of yours in color, then I've got some photos I can send out by email.
Absolutely. Well, I really did enjoy that, and it was interesting seeing the process. I just wanted to make a quick comment. You know, I also have a wonder about what the future of guitar is. On the other hand, if we think back to the 80s, when, in fact, synthesized music and disco and so on were very popular, there does seem to be a hearkening back to something you can hold in your hands and actually feel it vibrate and make your own music, as opposed to, you know, something that's not as tactile and not as expressive. So I do think there's an opportunity for it to spring back, and it's part of the cycle of a music life, perhaps.
I love this guy. This is a great listener. Never stop listening to this station, mate. Yes, that's a very interesting phenomenon. And in fact, I've talked to some guitarists who teach. I mean, I'm talking about, say, for example, you know, electric guitarists who teach. And they say one of the things that they're seeing is more and more kids, and now we're talking about, you know, young kids, 16, 17, 18, 19 years old, who want to learn to play the acoustic guitar.
Mm-hmm.
Now, quite likely, the guitar they have may well be a hybrid. It may have a, you know, built-in pickup or a built-in EQ or something like that, so that, you know, they can amplify it. But I think you're absolutely right. There's a certain segment of the population that is now doing this whole kind of back to physical reality thing, and they're really going for the acoustic guitar. The other thing that's happened, and I'm now thinking of your previous caller, is that an increasing number of women are buying guitars that are not the big, clunky old Dreadnought guitars, but are guitars that, you know, fit mm-hmm. under the arm better, smaller-bodied guitars. And so you're getting something of a revolution in guitar styles as well for that reason.
Interesting.
So this, and I think that your current caller is absolutely right. The physical intimacy of the instrument is really one of its most enduring qualities and one of the things that make people sort of love it the most.
Well, Tim, thank you. I will see you on Thursday.
Great.
Okay, thanks for the call. Let me quickly mention also the event on Thursday, 2 to 4 p.m. this Thursday at the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, 236 Harding Band Building, which is 1103 South 6th Street. I'll put this all on our website, by the way. Our guest, Tim Brooks, will be speaking about the guitar, America's guitar in 20th century pop culture. So that's one event where you have a chance to hear from him and meet him. Also, on Friday the 30th, he'll be appearing at 3 p.m. on the Gary O'Brien Show on WDWS AM 1400. Hey, how about that? I just plugged WDWS.
See, the guitar makes us better people, nobler
That's right.
people.
That's right. No, we're fine with that. Also, on Saturday the 1st, you'll be doing a demonstration reading and book signing with a luthier in town, I believe, at Pages for All Ages.
Yes, I'm looking forward to that very much. One of the things people love is hearing about the guitar and then having somebody there who can show you the pieces, you know, so you can see what's in there and how it all goes together.
Absolutely. And for people who don't know, a luthier is somebody who makes guitars. So there you go. And also, you're doing a demonstration at 8:30 Saturday night at Verde Gallery in Champaign. Are you going to do some playing?
Yeah.
I'll
bring along my guitar. And actually, one of the things that is sort of the added bonus of coming along to one of my readings is that I let other people play the guitar that the book is all about. And I was recently at a festival in California, and someone said, "I just drove here from Yosemite just so I could see that guitar." And I said, "Heck, play it."
So you let people play your guitar?
Oh, yeah.
Talk about gracious. That's very nice.
Well, no one's dropped it yet.
Oh, good. Please, folks, don't drop his guitar. We have a caller waiting. I don't want to make them wait too long, and then, you know, we'll follow up with some more questions, perhaps, if I have time. Next up, Urbana listener, line number two. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes.
Conversation a few minutes ago about guitars and children in schools and the difficulty finding instruments. Seems appropriate to plug a program at Edison Middle School in Champaign. This is the second year of a program to teach low-income kids guitar. And last year they started with 25 guitars, and they're trying to expand the program. And I just received a solicitation for $100. They're trying to find 50 people to give $100 to expand this very popular program.
What a great another 25 program.
Well, your interest in this, I'm going to give a phone number for Edison Middle School, so if anyone listening wants to contribute to the guitar program, but I'm sure when you're in town, you're going to be very busy, but you might enjoy visiting these kids in a middle school who are taking up guitar.
If I can squeeze it in my schedule, I'd love to do that.
But for anybody who wants to contribute to this, the phone number at Edison is 351-3771. And the coordinators of the program are Judith Gordon and Rosalie Otto, who also has the virtue of being my sister-in-law. Thank you.
Okay. Rosalie, what was the last name?
Otto, O-T-T-O.
Okay, that's great.
And the phone number at Edison is 351-3771. And the school board has no money to fund this, so for it to continue, they're relying on extra donations. So they are fundraising now to buy 25 more guitars and to expand the program from their first year. So,
well, that's
sounds
wonderful.
Like a great program.
Well, thanks so much for the call about that.
Yeah, thanks for calling in.
I'll put that information on our website after the show, by the way, so people can look there as well. You know, there's one thing I wanted to ask you about, and that is the quality of the instrument, because one thing, and you note, you know, at one point in the book, in a little section, you call the worst guitar in the world. I think it's really important, and I see this sometimes. There are so many instruments out there, and actually, there's a range of instruments that are quite good for increasingly little in terms of cost. But, folks, if you buy your kids a guitar, or if you're, you know, if you want to help somebody learn it. I guess I would make a plea not to give somebody a really bad instrument.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the guitar has a lot of advantages, but it has one major disadvantage, which is that when you first start playing it, it hurts.
Yeah.
Especially if it's a steel string guitar.
Right.
And for those of you who have a child who might be interested in playing the guitar and you don't really feel that you yourself know much about the guitar to be able to judge, it's very simple. What you do is you pick up the guitar you're thinking of buying, especially if it's a steel string guitar, and then you take a finger, any finger, and put it over the string right in the middle of the string's length. So in other words, halfway up, sort of at the top of the fingerboard and near the sound hole, and you press that string down. And if it requires much effort to hold that string down, and if it starts cutting into your fingers, then heaven knows the action is very high. The neck may already be warping, and it'll be really hard for your kids to play. Probably a good idea, actually, if you can do it, is to start the kid off either with a small-size classical guitar, a full-size classical guitar. The neck is kind of wide for small fingers, but you can get student-size, like half-size and three-quarter-size guitars. Because a classical guitar, of course, has the nylon strings, which don't hurt. Or, and this obviously could cause major trouble, an electric guitar, because the electric guitar, the action is much easier. It's much easier to play. And then you'll just have to figure out a way to kind of drive a nail into the volume knob so the kid can't turn it all the way up.
Right. Or get a very small amplifier or something. Yeah. Well, we're past our midpoint here. We're talking with Tim Brooks. He is the author of the book we're discussing, Guitar, An American Life, published by Grove Press. He's also taking part in the Wall-to-Wall Guitar Festival at the Kranitz Center for the Performing Arts this coming week, Thursday through Sunday. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you're welcome to do so. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And we have another Indiana listener on line number four. Good morning.
Hello?
Yes.
Why, I wonder if your guest has ever heard of Holland's Modern Method for the Guitar.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I've actually got a picture of Justin Holland that I'm going to be bringing up to the Sousa Archives.
Well, I have a copy of this.
You're kidding!
Published in 1876, S. Brainerd & Sons in Chicago, Illinois.
Oh, that's a remarkable thing. That was, at the time, it was one of the single most popular guitar method books ever published in this country.
And it works.
Oh, good.
Does it? I mean, doesn't, I'm asking.
You mean, would I recommend it as a sort of a teaching tool?
Yes.
I don't know. That's a great question. I know that...
Well, would you like to have this book?
I'd love to have that book.
Well, if you can maybe off air or something, give me a way to send it to you, I'd be glad to.
That sounds terrific. To answer your other question, there have been several revolutions in guitar teaching methods since then. But on the other hand, if that book became so popular and he was so highly regarded as a teacher and a player, then there must be something in it.
Mm-hmm.
He was a very interesting figure, as you may well know. He was African-American, and like many African-Americans, no matter how talented musicians they were, they were sort of allowed, in quotes, to play various folk instruments, which is why you find the guitar, one of the reasons why you find the guitar being so popular, but they weren't allowed to join the major orchestras and play the classical orchestra instruments. And in fact, Justin Holland, despite being such a widely renowned person and having such success with these method books, died in poverty, as did many really remarkable classical black musicians of the 19th century. But yes, I'd love to give you my address off the air, and I'd love to see that book.
Okay. Well, if you will make some arrangement now, I mean, for me to give...
Well, I have an idea. How about, can I put you on hold and I'll ask Henry Frayne, our director, to take your phone number, if that's okay, and I will make sure that you get the information?
Okay.
Is that acceptable?
Yes, that would be fine.
Okay, great. I'm going to put you on hold, and thanks so much. It's very gracious.
Yeah, thank you.
There's so much in the book. There's so many great stories, and since we don't have any callers waiting, let me just kind of bear through some of the most interesting things to me. Shifting to the 20th century, we had a very remarkable technological development, and that is the right about the turn of the century, the recording revolution, where actually music could finally be saved in some way that could be later played back, and this had a tremendous impact on the guitar.
Well, it really had a tremendous impact on everything, on every aspect of music. And I actually talk about the invention of recording as being a bargain with the devil, because what that really did was, on the one hand, to make music available to a wide range of people who otherwise might not have had any means of listening to music, because, in the early 20th century, America was extremely rural. A lot of places very, very isolated. You might never hear live music of any kind. So on the one hand, it did that. On the other hand, what it started to do was to turn music from a shared experience into a commodity. And you already had... To a certain extent, a music industry, because you already had a music publishing industry that was publishing sheet music. But as soon as you get the recording industry developing, then you start getting a huge number of middlemen who are going to be, you know, making much of the money that otherwise might go to musicians or composers or performers. And secondly, you get the whole sense that people from then on began to make music that sounded like the music that was recorded, instead of making the kind of music they had made all along or the kind of music they wanted to make. There was clearly a sense that this certain kind of music were popular and successful. And this was often utterly ridiculous. So, for example, you know the way bluegrass singers sing? There is this this joke that a bluegrass band is three men sharing a single sinus.
Mm.
Well, what happened was that some of the early country recordings that took place in the rural Southeast, it just so happened that one or two of those recordings happened to feature people who had that kind of old-style country singing voice, whereas many of the others had trained voices and sang opera, for example, in their spare time, because opera is very popular. Certain records did very well, and people thought, okay, so this is what people expect to hear. And that particular vocal style became the sort of the standard for recorded music, even though many of the musicians felt it was really insulting. They said, you know, we can sing better than that. And the same thing happened with blues. There was a tremendous shift in what kind of blues people were prepared to kind of pay to hear or pay to record. And that then became really the sort of the dominant act in American music. So now you have a situation where the majority of music that you hear is not live. In fact, the vast majority of music that you hear is not live, and music is much more a commodity than a performance. And I think there's huge loss associated with that, even though there's also benefit.
We're moving to our last 12 minutes or so with Tim Brooks discussing his book, Guitar in American Life. We have one caller waiting and time for others if you'd like to join us pretty quickly. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Another Urbana listener here on line number one. Good morning.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to plug the Vintage Instrument Show this Friday and Saturday that is in conjunction with the Wall-to-Wall Guitar Festival at Tech Lines Friday afternoon and Saturday from 10 in the morning to 7 at night. We have quite a collection of five-string banjos. There'll be some guitars for sale, but a lot of vintage instruments. On Saturday afternoon, we'll have luthiers Rich Klein and Paul Breen to do a workshop on simple guitar setup for players. Something every guitar player needs to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I have to take exception with you that the guitar made America. I think the five-string banjo did. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call. I appreciate that.
One of the things that I love about this festival, and this is typical of David Spellman, who's been organizing it, is that he comes at the guitar from many, many, many different angles. And consequently, the whole subject becomes much more than just, you know, a show. And there are all sorts of different things that you can do and you can join in with. And they make you understand some of the connections between the guitar and other features of American society. And so just by looking at the calendar of events coming up, straight away you sort of go, wait a second, this is really something that's happening. It's not just, you know, the typical show where you have, you know, three big names and an opening act kind of thing.
No, it's amazing that the people, and I don't think I even mentioned any of the names that are going to be. So let me just quickly mention some of the people who are going to be involved in it. Taj Mahal, Pat Metheny, Christian McBride, Daniel Lanois, Bill Frisell, Rory Block, Andy Summers, Vernon Reed, Simone Shaheen, David Tronzo, Burning Air, Banning Air, Cindy Cash Dollar, Red Volkart, Elliot Fisk, and it actually, you know, I could Khaki King is another amazing, you know, young talent that's going to be performing. It would take, you know, 10 minutes to even say anything meaningful about all these people. It's just astonishing.
Yep. And what I love is that the people I know of from that list are just spectacular. And there are people I've never even heard of
right.
on that list. So I'm thinking, wow, what am I going to learn there?
Well, we have another caller. Let's include them. We'll go next to line number one, someone in Urbana. Good morning.
Hi. We often don't go to small club performances of music because the sound is too loud. And I've even been disappointed a couple of times. We went to see Indigo Girls at Cranert, and the last time we went to see an a cappella group which had a band backing them up part of the time. It was Sweet Honey in the Rock.
Mm-hmm.
They have themselves with these feedback speakers so they can hear themselves, but the sound gets too loud and too muddy for me. And at times it's hurt my ears.
Sure.
And it's really sad because the acoustics are supposed to be pretty good in our, at least at, you know, at Cranert. And in the smaller places, I don't see why they have to have the sound so loud. So I don't know if you can get the word out to people, but it would be nice to not have ear damage, hearing damage, and to be able to hear the subtleties without being blasted out of my seat. With this a cappella group, which isn't, we're not talking about guitar here, but a lot of the times I could not understand the words.
Yeah.
There was one song that people, that they were singing, I only understood two words that were repeated over again, and I didn't know the song. Other people did, but various people had the same problem. So anyway, that's my small contribution. I'm hoping that the performance we're going to get to hear this weekend will not be over mic'd and amped and so forth with these feedback speakers. I read somewhere that Bose had found a way to mic acoustic sounds, acoustic performances for a particular size of venue, which doesn't fit the Cranert, any of the Cranert theaters.
Right.
Well. But I thought that was a really interesting thing. I hope that they continue working on that so that we can get clearer sound. Thanks.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call. Note to Mike Ross at Cranert. That's something in the sound person's hands, I suppose.
And I have to say that if it's any consolation, many of the musicians complain even more about the quality of the sound than the audience does.
That's certainly true. Yes. Well, we just have about maybe 7 minutes left, and there's so many stories to talk about from the book. One I found really fascinating, though, and of course it's a thread that you see throughout the history of guitar in America, and that's the relationship between guitar and class status in the country. And, you know, sort of the rise and fall depending on perhaps the fashions, and then at various times, you know, it's something that is regarded as, you know, less than legitimate and so forth. You know, and it's interesting to see how then commercial culture has embraced it and used it as a sort of a merchandising and marketing, you know, vehicle as well.
Yes, it's very interesting. Someone wrote a review of the book that by and large was very complimentary, but said, you know, I wish he wouldn't keep bringing up these issues of class. I wish he wouldn't kind of push his political views on us. And yet the fact is that if you go back to newspapers around, let's say, the mid-1950s, it's really clear that the guitar, insofar as it's thought of at all, is thought of as, and this is the term they would use, a hillbilly instrument or a nigger instrument. And it's had such strong racial and sociological connotations that it became a sort of a radical act to pick one up and sing one, which is why the sort of the folk revival, which begins happening in the 1950s when people start playing guitars and banjos, which of course were seen even more as a hillbilly instrument. That was a radical act. And then when rock and roll started, the first 1956 American rock and roll boom first starts. Again, one of the reasons why people hated the guitar was not only because it was loud, but because it was a blue-collar instrument. It was a hillbilly instrument and a blue-collar instrument, and that was very distasteful to kind of urban middle-class audiences. And in fact, you can see that in the cartoon Huckleberry Hound, because Huckleberry Hound occasionally plays a guitar. And it's a guitar that has only two strings and only three tuners, and it's clearly a joke. It's supposed to be, satire on these backwoods people who play their guitars and their banjos. And so class was absolutely an issue, and it was only overthrown by the Beatles, who came in from outside and so kind of produced a different impact and a different visual image and a different sound using the same old instruments. And it was sufficiently different that the old class barriers got overcome.
Speaking of the Beatles and the British invasion, is it really true that Joe McCarthy helped sort of start the British invasion?
Well, yes, it absolutely is true, because as I say in the book, the British invasion really began the other way around. It began in 1950, when the House Un-American Activities Committee were making things very hot for anybody who was the slightest bit liberal. And one of the people who left the country rather than be pestered by them was the folklorist and guitarist Alan Lomax. And he went over to England, and he was a completely unsinkable character. He turned up at the BBC and said, we should make a series called Ballads and Broadsides, I think it was called, or Ballads and Blues. He basically got them to make a radio series that combined British Isles folk music with American folk music, which was the first time that many people had ever heard American folk music, which a term, by the way, which included the blues. And it was phenomenally popular. It had an audience of something like 10 million in a country of only 40 million. And amongst the people who were then kind of brought over to Europe were a lot of the great American blues musicians of the time, plus people like Sister Rosetta Tharpe. And they made such an impression, as did, say, a folk musician like Ramblin' Jack Elliott, on the young kids that Keith Richard and Mick Jagger and John Lennon were inspired by, when they were young kids, by these musicians to go out and pick up American music and to pick up the guitar. So really, if it hadn't been for Joe McCarthy and the House Un-American Activities Committee, Alan Lomax would never have gone over there. That connection might never have happened.
And what's so amazing about that story, and we hear this time and time again, I suppose, that, people in England and in Europe probably as well knew more about American music of the guitar music, certainly, and a lot of the folk music that was going on, including blues and so forth, than Americans did.
Well, yes, and it may not have been true in terms of number, but it was certainly true in terms of passion. And you started getting these very, very intense, very passionate groups of blues enthusiasts. And Browning McGee tells the story of arriving in Southampton and being surrounded by people calling out his name and cheering and clapping and stuff. And he's looking around saying, who are they here for? And when the Beatles first came to the United States, and there was a radio interviewer, maybe it was Murray the K, I can't remember, who said, what are you going to see? What are you looking forward to seeing, when you're in America? John Lennon said, Chuck Berry and Muddy Waters. And the interviewer said, where are they, or where's that? Didn't even know that they were people's names. And John Lennon, of course, who wasn't was not shy, said, you don't even know your own culture. You don't even know your own music. And at that particular point, with the exception of really just a small number of people who were getting involved in the Newport folk scene and the old Old Town School of Music in Chicago, that was really true.
We have literally about 2 minutes left, and there's so much more we're not going to have time to speak about, but certainly there are opportunities for folks who are listening to interact with our guest, Tim Brooks. Let me just ask you, how'd your guitar turn out? I mean, part of the story of the book is the building of the guitar. Was it what you hoped and dreamed it would be?
Yes and no. I didn't really ever quite have a sense of what it would sound like or what it would look like, even though, you know, Rick Davis, the builder, kept saying, you know, well, should we do this or this? Do you want it to look like this or this? It still came as just an overwhelming surprise. I thought it was just stunning. And when I started playing it, I was sort of going, wow. And just recently, I was over in California at the biggest guitar makers convention in the world that happens every 2 years in Northern California. And I took it with me, and everybody was just blown away by it. It's probably not the greatest guitar, or it's not the greatest guitar ever made, but if you want a better guitar than this, you better be prepared to fork out $10,000.
Well, and it's something that I'm sure is going to grow on you over time. I mean,
it already has. It
exactly.
Absolutely.
Relationship. Yeah. It's not just
the other thing I say about it is that whenever I see it, I want to play it. And that's the kind of guitar you want. Whether it's new or old or fancy or not, you know, you want a guitar that you play.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to have to stop, but let me just mention a couple things before we hand things off. First of all, our guest, Tim Brooks, his book, Guitar and American Life, is published by Grove Atlantic Press, and it should be in bookstores and hopefully libraries, so you can look for that, and it's a great read. Also, he'll be speaking this Thursday, 2 to 4 p.m., at the Sousa Archives, Center for American Music, which is at 1103 South 6th Street in Champaign, right next to the Armory. And he'll be appearing on the Gary O'Brien Show 3 p.m. on Friday this week on WDWS. Also, Saturday, October 1st at 1 p.m., Tim Brooks will be doing a reading and demonstration at Pages for All Ages in Savoy, 8:30 p.m. that night at Verde Gallery. And then on Sunday, you're doing an event at Cranard, I believe?
I think so, yep.
Yes, I think. Well, I hope to hear you play, Tim. So, you know, that should be part of this.
Okay, I'll stop buffing my nails.
Okay. We'll have to leave it there, and thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.